Yeah, W-O-R-T Madison.
Do you have an insatiable curiosity about the world? Do you find yourself provoking conversations with your friends and coworkers? Are you a strong listener? Then you should consider applying to become the next host of A Public Affair, WORT's daily hour-long call-in talk program. We're now accepting applications for this volunteer position. The next host will be the voice of Tuesday's show and join a stellar lineup of folks who engage listeners in conversations on social, cultural, and political issues of importance every day of the week. We're looking for someone who is curious and well-informed, comfortable speaking on air, someone who can think on their feet and has at least 5 hours a week to prepare and host the show. And of course, we'll need you to be here every Tuesday from 12 to 1 p.m. Apply by May 2nd. To find out more information or apply, go to wortfm.org/talkhost.
BBC News with Sue Montgomery. The head of the European Central Bank says Donald Trump's sweeping new tariffs, expected to be announced later, will have a negative impact across the world. Christine Lagarde said the damage would depend on how extensive the tariffs were and whether they prompted new trade deals. Our correspondent in Washington, Peter Bowes, says Mr. Trump's approach has rattled consumers, businesses and markets.
There's a tremendous amount of concern around the world over looming trade war, also concern here at a domestic level about rising prices. But this is, as Donald Trump sees it, the beginning of an attempt by him to level the playing field in terms of trade between the United States and the rest of the world. And there's been a tremendous amount of speculation as to what that could mean, what the percentage in terms of those levies could be, which countries could be targeted. It could be every country around the world.
The head of Italy's main industry organisation has warned that the anticipated new tariffs pose a massive risk to the country's economy. Emanuele Orsini called for a cut in interest rates to offset their effects. He added that trade within Europe needed to increase. The Hamas-run civil defence agency in the Gaza Strip says an Israeli strike in a UN clinic housing displaced people has left at least 19 dead. The Israeli military says it targeted a Hamas command and control centre in the Jabalia refugee camp. Here's our Middle East regional editor, Mike Thompson.
Gaza's civil defence agency says 9 of those killed in the strike were children. They were sheltering in a UN clinic that's been used to house displaced people. The Israeli military says it had targeted Hamas militants there. Israel has frequently claimed that Hamas fighters often hide among civilians who are used as human shields. Hamas has denied this. The strikes follow an announcement by Israel's defense minister Israel Katz of another big expansion of the military operation in Gaza that will require a large-scale evacuation.
China's carried out military manoeuvres around Taiwan for a second day, practicing the targeting of energy facilities and ports. On Tuesday, Chinese forces simulated a blockade of the democratically run island, which Beijing considers its own territory. Taiwan said its military remained on high alert. At a news conference, Taiwan's defence ministry spokesman Sun Li Fang condemned the drills.
The People's Liberation Army of China announced a new name for the drills today, but no matter what the name is, it can't cover up the nakedly provocative nature of the drills and their mentality in threatening Taiwan's people.
China has been gradually increasing the scale of military exercises near Taiwan in recent years. BBC News.
The 2025 Wisconsin Film Festival is coming to Madison Thursday, April 3rd through Thursday, April 10th. This year's festival boasts over 170 films of all shapes and sizes, including the best cinema has to offer from all over the world and right here in Wisconsin. We've got comedies, dramas, experimental, animated, and student films, as well as documentaries, restored classics, films for kids, and more. This year we'll be showing films at the Bartell Theater and the Barrymore Theater, as well as four venues on the UW-Madison campus. And we'll be spending the last 4 days of the festival at Flick's Brewhouse at the Easttown Mall. The Wisconsin Film Festival curates, promotes, and exhibits programs that showcase the art of cinema. A complete festival guide is available in the March issue of Isthmus and online, and tickets are available at wifilmfest.org. The 2025 Wisconsin Film Festival is coming to a screen near you, Thursday, April 3rd through Thursday, April 10th. Helping keep local arts alive for almost 50 years, this is WORT Madison.
Midwest Jazz Collective presents the Benny Banach III Quartet for two shows at 7 and 9 p.m. on Monday, April 7th at Cafe Coda. Emmy-nominated trumpeter and singer Benny Banach III has proven to be that rarest of talents. Not only a fiery trumpet player with a stirring command of the post-bop trumpet vernacular, but also a singer with a sly, mature, naturally expressive delivery in the post-Sinatra mold. Third in a generational line of Pittsburgh jazz notables, Benny follows in the footsteps of his trumpeter and bandleader grandfather, Benny Banach Sr., and his father, Benny Banach Jr., who gave the young Benny his first professional experience. Benny's group includes Tyler Henderson on piano, Caleb Tabachman on bass, and Joe Perry on drums. More information at cafecoda.club. Midwest Jazz Collective presents the Benny Banach III Quartet for two shows at 7 and 9 p.m. on Monday, April 7th at Cafe Coda. You are listening to WORT Madison.
Support for this program comes from Orange Tree Imports, locally owned at 1721 Monroe Street in Madison for almost 50 years. Orange Tree Imports offers a wide array of gifts and kitchenware, including cookware, toys, specialty foods, and Wisconsin products. Information and store hours are available at orangetreeimports.com.
Good morning. It is Wednesday, April 2nd, and this is the 8 o'clock buzz. I'm Jan Miyasaki. This morning, I'll be speaking with Bridget Moix. Bridget Moix is General Secretary of the Friends Committee on National Legislation. So the Friends Committee on National Legislation is a national, nonpartisan Quaker organization that lobbies Congress and the administration to advance peace, justice, and environmental stewardship. And FCNL works with a grassroots network of tens of thousands of people across the country to advance policies and priorities established by its governing general committee. So I'll be speaking with Bridget Moix on her call for springtime for moral courage. She writes decades of work making our country and community safer, healthier, and more educated are being destroyed by the sweep of the president's pen and the whoosh of mass emails from Musk's Department of Government Efficiency team. FCNL and others are calling on Congress to show moral courage and act in the face of growing authoritarianism and devastating attacks on our democracy. So stay tuned to hear from Bridget Moix. Then later I'll be speaking with Amanda Starbuck. I'm senior food researcher and policy analyst at Food and Water Watch. And their research shows that corporate greed has played a major role in higher egg prices. We'll be talking about the report, The Economic Cost of Food Monopolies, The Rotten Egg Oligarchy. So stay tuned to hear from Amanda Starbuck. And then later, a story from last night's WORT News. It was ahead of the election results, but I wanted to play it. The city council race is flooded with real estate cash. But before then, Susan Crawford has defeated Brad Schimmel in a race that broke records for spending. It was the highest turnout in Wisconsin Supreme Court election history. And in a race that became a proxy fight for the nation's political battles, Crawford is beating Schimmel by 10 points based on unofficial results. Turnout exceeded 52% of the voting age population, topping the record set in 2023 of nearly 40%. And spending was on its way to surpassing $100 million. So, hey, we're going to take a break. Coming up, I'll be speaking with Bridget Moix. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
The idea.
10 minutes after 8, and joining me is Bridget Moix, General Secretary of the Friends Committee on National Legislation, the FCNL, a national nonpartisan Quaker organization that lobbies Congress and the administration to advance peace, justice, and environmental stewardship. And they work with a grassroots network of tens of thousands of people across the country to advance policies and priorities established by its governing general committee. Good morning, Bridget Moix. Thank you for joining me.
Good morning, Jan. Thanks so much for having me.
And so I had been wanting to speak with you because of, you know, what has been going on, the closing of the U.S. Institute for Peace, USAID, so many devastating losses. And then I saw your piece at the end of last month calling for springtime for moral courage. And so can you tell listeners, you know, what's been happening on Wednesdays about what you were thinking about writing this piece?
Sure. Thank you so much for finding that piece and wanting to talk about it. Of course, we are seeing really devastating and dangerous things happening in our government, and I'm sure your listeners are watching a lot of that and have a lot of concerns about what's happening. We know a lot of people, I've had friends and family talk about feeling paralyzed, sort of, you know, the overwhelm. This is actually a strategic effort of shock and awe. The administration's been very upfront about that. And so every day we see something new happening that feels like our government and our world and the lives of many people are being turned upside down and really devastated. And that can feel really overwhelming. But one of the things that is happening in springtime is renewal. And so I think we are, as a Quaker organization and with other colleague faith organizations and secular organizations that care about justice and peace and democracy, we are gathering each Wednesday on Capitol Hill for what we're calling Faithful Witness Wednesdays. And this is a time for us to come together to really call on Congress to play its role, to do its job as an independent branch of government who was really put into our Constitution to be a check on abusive power of other branches, including the administration. And we have not been seeing the leadership out of Congress that we think we really need. Now, I will put a caveat on that because Senator Cory Booker was on the floor of the Senate for 25 hours yesterday calling on this moral moment and sort of echoing this call that we've been issuing as well for more moral courage from our policymakers to stand up and push back against these really egregious and many unlawful actions that this administration is taking.
And you write that this time it seems a little bit different. The first Trump administration, you saw more large-scale street protests. Now something more focused, more advocacy, moving Congress to do its job. And so you're seeing more people kind of out and around Capitol Hill, just right ordinary people.
Yes, yes. That has been a real point of encouragement for us. We have seen over the last few weeks lines around the congressional office buildings. So my office at FCNL sits right across from the Senate office buildings. I can look out my window and see a little bit of what's happening there. And walking around Capitol Hill over recent weeks, we have watched lines forming to really enter the buildings and people from all across this country coming to Washington to advocate for the things they care about. I came out of the subway station on my way to work not long ago and saw busloads of nurses and healthcare workers getting off of these buses coming to Washington to say, don't cut healthcare, don't cut Medicaid. We have just had our own Spring Lobby weekend. We had over 330 young people, young adults from across the country coming to Washington, D.C. We train them, we educate them, and we send them to the Hill. And they were advocating with their members of Congress to protect SNAP and Medicaid. But people are coming from all across the country with many issues of concern and lobbying Congress, making their voices heard. And I think this is one of the most important things that we can be doing right now. So that is giving me some hope.
And because I just want to, I'm energized by hearing about all this. Can you talk about the Faithful Witness Wednesday Vigil? Who's there? It is interfaith, right?
It is interfaith, and I want to give a shout out to our colleagues at Sojourners who really conceptualized and led the start of this effort. But it has been taken up by many of our interfaith colleagues. So Christian, Jewish, Muslim, Buddhist, Hindu, folks are there from all walks of life, folks of conscience who may not identify with a particular religion, but see what's happening in our government and know there is a moral moment, as Senator Booker was saying on the floor of the Senate, that we need to speak into. It started on the Christian Holy Week. So it started on Ash Wednesday was the first time groups got together and said, we need to do something. It's being carried through Ramadan. It's being carried into April, and we'll have Passover as well. So it sort of aligns with some of the spring religious holidays for faith groups. But it is very diverse and inclusive, and it's been growing. So the first week, I would say there were maybe 25 to 30 people there. The next week there were 50. The next week there were 75 to 100. And we are streaming it, live streaming it, so people from all across the country can also tune in. And people have been tuning in larger and larger numbers, getting into the thousands. So we're seeing more and more people wanting a space of community courage and a time to really call for Congress to have that moral courage that our country needs right now. And we are aiming now to have a much larger gathering on April 30th. I will say that today, the Faithful Witness Wednesdays that we've been part of are joining up with Reverend Barber and his initiative, Repairers of the Breach, which is having a demonstration on the steps of the Supreme Court as well. So we're joining efforts today for that. And then we'll be continuing these witness times through April, at least, maybe beyond.
And so for some, to be politically active right now can be truly dangerous. And so really others have to embrace them, join hands around them, right?
Absolutely. I think as myself, as a white woman with, a lot of privilege, I feel like I have a responsibility to take risks that maybe other people cannot. I think as faith leaders who are leading this Faithful Witness Wednesday, I think we all feel a responsibility to be stepping up and speaking out and really, providing that voice, but also thinking about how we can be a protective presence when we need to be. That's certainly been one of the themes around protecting our neighbors from mass deportation, for instance.
No, you write moral courage is contagious. Say more about that.
Yeah, I think this is very true. I think fear can certainly be contagious. We know that, and we see that happening. Fear can drive people and even institutions to simply give up or comply. And I have a lot of concerns around some of what's happening with universities and others, institutions and people just being overwhelmed by the fear. And that's understandable, but courage is also contagious. When you see someone else standing up, it gives you a sense of this is possible. I can do this too. I think that we are seeing more and more people feel that spread of courage. And I am seeing it here in Washington. I hear about it. More demonstrations will be happening around the country this weekend, I know. And so I think communities are getting over some of that shock and awe and finding our feet and realizing that together we are much stronger than divided.
Now, the Friends Committee focuses on a range of topics, one of them peace building throughout the world. Can you talk about, when I originally wanted to talk with you, at the end of last month, the U.S. Institute of Peace was closed. Everyone laid off. I went to their website and it wasn't there anymore. I was wondering if you had any thoughts about how important USIP and then also USAID, those two agencies now, USAID's website as well, down. Can you talk about these kinds of government-funded organizations, and what do they do and why they're so important for peace building?
Sure. So our organization has a long history of supporting the creation of institutions and tools and funding and mechanisms within the U.S. government that can promote peace and support peace instead of war. We know the government has a lot of capacities to go to war and not nearly enough to build peace and prevent war. And so we have always, throughout our history, advocated for building these kinds of capacities. That included, actually, we supported the creation of the U.S. Institute of Peace in the 80s. And I'll just say it has been always a bipartisan institution, congressionally mandated and funded by Congress, but an independent institution. And it is not perfect. I have had plenty of complaints over the years about U.S. Institute of Peace. But I have also, and we as an organization, have worked with many, many good people and initiatives, and that institution has helped educate the public about peace building, and also done a lot of really good and important work around developing more policies related to peace and supporting peace building efforts around the world. It was forcibly taken over. So it wasn't just that the government cut funding or something. Been a threat in the past. It was forcibly taken over by people who do not have legal authority to take it over. There is a very clear process with the board and how, if you want to remove the head of the agency, who, by the way, was a very experienced ambassador. Ambassador George Moose was the acting head of U.S. Institute of Peace. Long, long history in diplomacy, Democrat, Republican, incredibly experienced person, simply pushed out, taken with DC police, where DOGE brought DC police to literally force their way into the institution when they tried to resist and say, you're not allowed to come into our independent agency. And they've now put in, a young 28-year-old tech person who may be very good intentioned. I don't know. I don't know anything about him, but certainly does not have experience in peace building. And they are dismantling the organization. They've laid everybody off, and they are now trying to take over what is private property, the building, and transfer it to the government. So there are court cases around all this. We're waiting to see what happens. But the fact that the government is going after institutions like USIP, which supports peace building, which is good for our country and the world, and has completely attacked USAID and been dismantling USAID. And I did do a two-year fellowship at USAID, so I will say that I learned a lot. Again, not a perfect institution. I have advocated for aid reform for many years, but this is no way to improve our government or the world. And so people are dying around the world because life-saving assistance that USAID provided, everything from HIV prevention in infants to food assistance for people who are starving, this is gone, to healthcare. So people are really impacted around the world by this. And these institutions may not have been perfect, but they were doing really critical life-saving work. And this is no way to act like we are improving the government or the world. It's really devastating.
And, what I think is taking it to the next level is that they're being scrubbed off the internet, that now you can't even look at what they had up there at all. It's just down. And that just seems to be taking this kind of attack to another level of censorship.
Yes, and I think there is an effort to erase institutions, to erase entire groups of people, frankly, to erase history, which is complicated. And there's good and there's bad in our country's history, and we need to know it all and understand it all. And so, yes, I agree with you. I think this effort to erase what has been and what has been really important progress and bipartisan progress over many years is very dangerous. Just to share a story briefly, I was in Poland a couple weeks ago as part of a seminar, helping teach a seminar for government officials on preventing genocide and atrocities. And it took place outside of Auschwitz. And part of the seminar is to tour Auschwitz. And it was a harrowing experience. And also watching the news out of the US while I was doing this was really, really sobering and frightening. Auschwitz began as a place that the Nazi regime started arresting and putting away political opponents, students, professors, people who disagreed with the regime. It became quickly a death camp, we know. The day I toured, I came out of that tour, I opened up the news from the US that day, and there was the news of a peace-building student from Georgetown University having been detained because of their political views. We are seeing extremely dangerous things happening in our country right now, and we really need Congress and the public and all of us to stand up. And the courts are doing a lot. That's really important. And there is progress. I do have hope. I do see people standing up, speaking out. And I think that this springtime of moral courage is what we need and is starting to bloom.
You know, the Friends Committee has a strong statement at its website, you know, supporting diversity and equity and inclusion. I appreciate that because, you know, folks are really being careful and they're you know, that kind of risk, right?
Yes, and I see and have heard about institutions, and you know, we know there are private institutions which don't take government funding, there's no direct threat to them, who are just closing down all their programs that promoted diversity, equity, inclusion. Mm-hmm. FCNL is very committed to our work on anti-racism, anti-bias, justice, equity, diversity, and inclusion. And we're not gonna change that. And I think it's really important that people continue to stand up for the amazing, beautiful diversity that is this country. This is what makes America great. This is what makes our country so strong. And we know, actually, if you want to talk about profits or good companies and how they work, we know diversity is a good thing in many, many ways. So we will continue to stand up for these values and the kind of world that we seek and we think is what we all really will benefit from.
Hey, Bridget Moix, General Secretary for Friends Committee on National Legislation. When you were in Poland, what were you hearing from people? You're observing this from afar. What did you detect and how people were reading what was going on in the U.S.?
Well, I experienced two things. First, just complete disbelief and people asking me, what is going on? What is happening in Washington? What is going on with the administration? Really shocked that our country could be turning, you know, decades of policies and practices upside down. I mean, the, you know, Trump administration's new alliance and relationship with Russia and claims that Ukraine started the war were baffling to people in Poland. Poland has been receiving refugees from Ukrainian refugees from this war. They're very close to that region. So they're very concerned about what's happening and they don't understand why, because it's not good for the world or the US. And they're asking, what are Americans doing about this? How are you going to help stop this, you know, as a democracy? And the second thing I experienced was I really did start to feel a little bit of when I was identified as an American, you know, just a little bit of kind of like, we're not sure we really want Americans here, you know, in a totally understandable way. But I think this is going to be bad for America and Americans, for our global reputation, for the kind of country that we are, and for people, for Americans when we travel.
Yeah, you know, And turning to domestic policy, Friends Committee on National Legislation is, you know, out there talking about safety net issues, food, basic needs. Can you talk about your concerns about what's happening there?
Yes, absolutely.
Healthcare.
So many things are at risk right now in a budget process, which is the administration's top legislative agenda. There are the tax cuts expiring, for which really benefit, the majority of the benefits go to wealthy, the top wealthy people in this country. Those tax cuts are expiring. And so what is happening is the administration and the leadership in Congress, the Republican leadership in Congress, are designing budget packages that would literally take money from poor and vulnerable people in this country, take away food assistance benefits, the SNAP program, which, you know, helps over 40 million people get food on their tables for them, their families and their kids. Take away funding from Medicaid, which serves 70 million people. Take away these life-saving, critical human needs funds and put them directly into the pockets of the rich and the wealthy through these tax cuts, through extending these tax cuts. Also, these budget proposals include a lot of funding, government funding, which is not efficient or effective for mass deportation, for building, you know, a bigger security wall around our country, which does not work, and for increasing the military budget. So this is, you know, we talk about the values of this country. I do not see how taking from the poor to give to the rich and to give to war and weapons and harming our neighbors, it represents our values as a country. So we're very, very concerned with this. We're actively advocating and lobbying Congress to protect those SNAP benefits, food assistance, healthcare, protect those programs that support families in this country and those in need, and not increase the funding for tax cuts for the wealthy, for mass deportation, for the military.
So Bridget Moix is part of a call, a growing call for springtime, for moral courage. Bridget Moix, you said you had hope. So I guess I'm gonna pin you down on that, I guess. Is it something tangible, something intangible? Where is that hope coming from?
Well, part of what I learned from my mentors here at FCNL and in the Peace and Quaker world is that hope is not a noun, it is a verb. So we create hope and we create courage when we take action. And it can feel overwhelming to figure out what can I possibly do as an individual in this incredible situation where our world is being turned upside down. But there are actions we can all take every day, whether that's calling your member of Congress, writing your member of Congress, getting to the polls and vote. There was a pretty important election there in Wisconsin yesterday. Doing things in our neighborhoods, with our communities that help build community and support people who may need support right now. So there are actions we can all take every day, and those actions add up. And that gives me a lot of hope. Those actions are what creates the hope and makes that courage contagious. So I do have hope. And if you need a dose of it, just go listen to Senator Cory Booker from some of his speech yesterday. It was pretty inspiring.
Yes. The call for springtime, for moral courage, you're right, Congress must begin acting like an independent branch representing the American people in all of our diversity. Hey, thank you, Bridget Moix. I really appreciate you staying on a little bit longer with me this morning, past 8:30. Bridget Moix, General Secretary of the Friends Committee on National Legislation, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you so much, Jan.
Thank you. Thank you, Bridget. Hey, it's just about 8:35. Amanda Starbuck, thank you for standing by. We'll hear a little bit of music and come back with Amanda Starbuck from Food and Water Watch.
Someday you'll come along. The man I love. Thank you.
Joining me is Amanda Starbuck, Senior Food Researcher and Policy Analyst at Food and Water Watch. Their research shows that corporate greed has played a major role in higher egg prices. They have a report titled The Economic Cost of Food Monopolies, The Rotten Egg Oligarchy. Wanted to talk with her about that. You know, good morning, Amanda. You know, I had a coworker show me a receipt for $12 for a dozen eggs bought in downtown Madison. Don't think that's common, but I did see the receipt with my own eyes. Good morning. Thank you for joining me.
Oh, my goodness. Thanks for having me. Yeah, I've heard similar stories from across the country. I mean, higher than what we're seeing even on the inflation data at the national level.
So can you kind of talk about, let's just talk about the report, sure. The Rotten Egg Oligarchy. And, you know, these big egg producers, which is just an ugly, actually, thought, but thought to me. But can you talk about the report and the big egg producers?
Yeah, so we started this report because we had a suspicion that there might be more going on to the egg price spikes that we had seen. In fact, when you look at inflation data, egg prices were already rising prior to the first outbreak of bird flu for this current outbreak. So this outbreak's been going on for about 3 years, started in February 2022. But the year previous to that, eggs were already going up in price. I mean, we saw overall inflation increasing over the past few years. And so then when the bird flu outbreaks began again, we started to see these price spikes. And so we had a suspicion that there might be more going on than what we were seeing. There have been past examples of like price gouging during, you know, different emergencies. For instance, there have been at least two lawsuits brought on against two different major egg companies for price gouging during the COVID-19 pandemic. One of which is still ongoing, one of which did actually get completed, and they were found, the egg company Hillendale was found guilty of price gouging at the beginning of the pandemic in New York. So we have, you know, history of this happening within the industry. And so we are, you know, asking ourselves, is bird flu just kind of like a cover to, you know, an excuse to raise prices above and beyond what was necessary? So what we did is we looked at inflation data, both at the national level and also at the regional data. We looked at data from USDA looking at, for instance, egg production, flock sizes, retail availability of eggs. And we used that first like year and a half of the outbreak because we hadn't good data for that time. And what we saw are that the price spikes we saw at both the national and regional levels didn't really seem to reflect what was actually happening at the farm level. So, for instance, during the first year of the bird flu outbreaks, total flock in the U.S. never went below 7% from the five-year monthly average. Total egg production never fell more than like 6%. But prices were going up 100, 200%, which is telling us that there might be more going on there. And so then we asked ourselves, you know, maybe it's just a regional thing. Maybe there are some regions that are doing okay, but perhaps there are huge shortages in other regions that are pushing up those average prices. So we took a regional approach and we looked specifically at the U.S. Southeast. So that region had no outbreaks in bird flu up until January 2025. So they went through 3 years of the bird flu epidemic without a single outbreak in their flocks. They actually produced more eggs than they had in previous years. And retail inventories of eggs during that first year and a half were actually above the five-year average, yet they were still experiencing those extreme price spikes that were happening at the national level. So that's telling us that, you know, there's something going on with the way egg pricing is that even in regions that were not experiencing any sort of outbreaks, we're still experiencing those you know, wild price spikes that we've all seen at the grocery store.
So listeners here will know that, you know, there are ways that you might be able to directly buy eggs from somebody that you know who has hens. But there is this kind of egg monopoly, right? And who are these large producers? And they are large. It's like only like a handful of them, right? And where do they sell their eggs? Yeah. Just kind of talk about big egg.
Absolutely, yeah. So there are big egg. It's pretty concentrated, not as severe as like meat, chicken, and beef, but still the top 10 companies control about 50% of the egg market. None of those top companies are private, so we unfortunately can't easily access, you know, financial data on them. But the biggest egg producer in the nation, Cal-Maine, is a publicly traded company, which means they have to submit data on their finances to the shareholders and make that publicly available to everybody. So we focused on Cal-Maine, and they are huge. So I mentioned the top 10 control about half the market. Cal-Maine alone controls about a fifth of the market. So about one every five eggs that we eat comes from Cal-Maine. You might never have heard of them. They don't really sell under their actual company name, but they license to sell under different trademarks. And they have their own trademarks as well. So it's quite likely if you eat eggs that you've had a Cal-Maine egg before. And so, as mentioned, they are the largest egg producer. They're vertically integrated. So that means that they basically control about every step of the production. So they raise their own chicks and hatcheries. They send them to pullet farms where they basically mature. And then they send those hens, when they're mature enough to lay eggs, to a laying facility. They also package and warehouse and distribute the eggs as well. And they sell to market to retailers. So I think Walmart is like their largest customer. And so, you know, there isn't really much of a middleman in this business. And it's not, you know, some eggs do go into processed foods, but for the most part, it's one of those few foods that we see that really only a couple of companies have their hands on before it makes it to the consumer.
So, you know, when you essentially corner them, you know, one fifth of the market, and you your price fluctuates a dollar, this is a huge profit that they make, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. So the interesting thing about Cal-Maine is we looked at their fiscal data. We compared, so their fiscal year goes from like June through May. And so we looked at their fiscal year 2023, which was entirely within the bird flu epidemic. Compare that to fiscal year 2021, which is entirely outside of it. And in those years, their prices like almost tripled in terms of what they charge their eggs for. But they actually were producing more eggs in 2023 than in 2021. They were not hit with a single bird flu outbreak in their flocks until December of 2023. So they made it almost 2 years through this outbreak. And so during that fiscal year that we looked at, there wasn't a single outbreak in any other flocks. They had no reason to raise their prices as far as they did. So we did a calculation. We looked at, okay, what were their actual increases in costs? You know, there were some modest increases in energy and in feed. And then we looked at, okay, so how much did they raise their prices above that profit margin? And we found that their profit margins increased by, as you mentioned, a dollar per dozen eggs sold. And since they sell a billion or more dozen eggs every year, their windfall profit was $1 billion. And again, $1 billion paid on the backs of consumers like us who have had to face these rising egg prices.
And that, I'll just say, and that's legal to have 20% of the egg market.
Unfortunately, we have not been great at really, you know, scrutinizing mergers. We have antitrust laws in the books. I believe we need to improve them and strengthen them, but we also need to enforce them. And so I can't speak specifically to every merger they've taken, but, you know, when a company that large acquires additional companies, I mean, they should be scrutinized. Those mergers should be scrutinized, acquisitions, to see, is that going to give them an unfair advantage? And unfortunately, that's been the case all across the food industry, and in fact, across our whole economy, is, you know, mergers continuing to happen. And companies, you know, rather than, I mean, it's kind of hard to innovate in the egg industry, but you see that in the tech industry and the medical industry, that rather than trying to innovate and gain more market share that way, really the way that things have been going in our economy is to buy out the smaller ones. And so increase your market share by buying out your competitors. And unfortunately, we all lose in that situation because prices tend to go up and innovation tends to go down.
Now, did you look at the numbers of eggs that were, laid, delivered to market? Did it fall so much to really account for most of this pricing that there was somehow a deep need to ration them?
So again, we're kind of looking at that first year of the outbreak. Things have gotten a little bit more severe in like January and February of this year, and there were some actual significant shortages. But still, we believe the prices were above and beyond what were necessary. But during that first year of the outbreak, I mean, the total retail availability did not really change all that much. Americans ate about 3.5 fewer eggs a piece. So it's not like people were going without eggs. They were finding them. They were just costing a lot more. And so, yeah, we found no evidence in that first year for these massive price spikes.
No.
And again, too, you know, companies that do have an outbreak on their farms, there are indemnity programs. USDA will actually pay for any kind of birds that need to be culled. So when you have an outbreak on your farm, it's fatal to birds. And so you call up your local authorities and they call the flock, and any birds that have to be culled, you actually get paid for. So there is some reimbursement too. They're not completely left, you know, hanging when it comes to these outbreaks as well.
Now, this eggflation, you call it, in your report, is it here to stay, this kind of high prices? Will we never see sort of low cost, affordable eggs?
I think that eggs for $1 a dozen are gone. I think that's in the past. Even without the outbreaks, I think we already saw the trends going up in terms of food inflation. And the unfortunate thing is, so this is, eggs are considered a staple, you know, a necessity. They long have been a cheap form of protein. They're harder to replace in certain dishes, and they end up in lots of different processed foods. And so even when prices are really high and, you know, consumers still don't really cut back as much. And so that's one count against them, where, you know, people are still going to likely buy them. And so that demand is going to be there regardless of what, you know, this is not a perfect supply and demand situation just because it is a staple. The second point being is that food staples tend to be price sticky, which means that when prices go up, you know, for whatever reason, they tend not to come down all the way again. And we've seen that. We've never seen egg prices go back down to where they were pre-outbreak levels. So I'm afraid that, yeah, that's, you know, companies are going to realize that, well, people are still buying eggs and they're $10, $12 a dozen. So maybe we'll reduce prices a little bit, but maybe we'll continue to ride this wave of high prices.
Now, there have been lawsuits, particularly I'm reading about the lawsuit against Calmaine. Can you talk about, you know, recommendations that Food and Water Watch makes based upon what you find?
Yeah. So, this isn't just, you know, a shot in the dark to say that there might be, that these companies need to be investigated. I mean, there have been, like you mentioned, past histories. I mean, Calmaine, I think, is still engaged in a lawsuit with the state of Texas for alleged price gouging in the pandemic. They were also named in a lawsuit that was brought on by Kraft Foods. So major food industries that rely on eggs sued various egg producers, as well as an egg trade group, for price fixing, and they won that suit as well. And so there has been, you know, within this industry specifically, and within these companies that we mentioned, a history of these lawsuits against them. And so we do believe that, you know, the federal government should step in and really analyze and look at what's going on here. There has been rumors that the Department of Justice might be investigating the major egg producers, which we welcome. We think that they should definitely move forward with that. We recommend that they also engage the Federal Trade Commission. They tend to work, you know, in conjunction with these sorts of suits. And then, you know, continuing to uphold our existing antitrust laws, that's, unfortunately, they have not really been enforced as much in the past, as I mentioned. You know, even laws that, for instance, it's illegal to give special prices to certain customers that you don't provide to others. Yet this is something that has happened, you know, Walmart being such a huge retailer. And again, as I mentioned, they purchase a lot of Calmaine eggs. You know, they've been able to kind of strong arm their suppliers to give them a sweetheart deal, which this means those suppliers have to charge more for the local mom and pop shops. That's illegal, but it's been happening. And so, yeah, we really need to enforce the antitrust legislation that we have. We also would support, you know, stronger legislation that would prevent price gouging. There have been bills that have tried to do this in the past, so we would welcome, you know, and renewed efforts to try to get, you know, more stronger legislation on the books and then, of course, to enforce it.
Now, I'm trying to. So is there any hope? There is the Farm System Reform Act to stop the growth of factory farms and to help fund a transition to smaller sustainable farming systems. Is there any hope for that in the future? The Price Gouging Prevention Act? Another one?
Yeah. I mean, those are ambitious legislation. I think they might take, you know, a few sessions to really kind of gain some momentum. But what we're trying to draw attention to in this report is that role of the factory farms in these outbreaks, right? When you have the average factory farm in the U.S. housing 850,000 birds. Cal Maine, for instance, their farms run about 1 million apiece. There have been farms that have been hit with bird flu, one in Iowa that was 4.3 million hens that had to be culled. So when you have an operation of that size, you know, your hens are going to be more stressed out. They're going to be more susceptible to disease. They don't have access to fresh air. So when disease hits, it's going to be pretty serious. And when you have a farm of that magnitude, it's going to really magnify those impacts on the local economy, right? Losing 4 million hens is a much bigger deal than losing 20,000 hens. And we can really see that when we look at, you know, what's happening in Canada. I mean, we share, you know, the same kind of migration, you know, migratory bird routes that they have. And so the same birds that might be spreading, you know, helping to facilitate the spread in the U.S. are also flying into Canada. But there, their average laying hen operation is around 25,000. And so although they've been impacted, it has not been to the same degree as in the U.S. And they have not seen the price spikes that they've seen in the U.S. And there's some, you know, consideration that maybe this has to do in part to the fact that they don't have that factory farm model like we do here. And so really the really egregious part of it is, you know, we believe that factory farms are exacerbating and magnifying the impacts of this outbreak. And at the same time, companies like Cal Maine, who run these factory farms, who thrive and profit off of them, are also profiting off of the impacts of bird flu as well. So it's a system that both exacerbates, you know, this outbreak while also providing, you know, opportunities for companies to make windfall profits.
I'm speaking with Amanda Starbuck, the senior food researcher and policy analyst at Food and Water Watch. Amanda Starbuck, what is the? Can you talk more about some of this DOJ, Department of Justice action? I hope it will continue the antitrust action against companies. Is it like I'm reading? It's Urner Barry? Is that it? What is Urner Barry?
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, so I'm not sure that the DOJ, it's very unclear what they're going to be looking at. It's just kind of initial rumors that we're hearing. Mm-hmm. I would hope that they would look at the Urner Barry Index. So I had never heard of this until I started this report. It is a third-party company that provides what they would call a benchmark price for eggs. So it's not like looking at the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. It's not looking at the stock market and looking at actual trades. They take information directly from producers on, you know, prices that they're selling their eggs at, as well as what they would call a market assessment. They don't really disclose what that means, but essentially they're taking information from egg producers, using that to, in their algorithm to spit out what they would call a benchmark price, where they think that egg prices are going. So if you're a company and you have power like Cal Maine, and you are, you know, providing data to this algorithm, and they come out with a benchmark price, you can confidently raise your price to meet that benchmark price, knowing that your competitors are going to as well. Now, that could be, you know, it could be completely legal, or, you know, we have concerns that there could possibly be being some sort of collusion that's being facilitated by this. We're not going to come out and say that, but we would like to see, you know, DOJ really take an investigation into Urner Barry just to see what is actually happening. And there's precedent for this. So the Department of Justice right now has a lawsuit against Agristats. So Agristats does a similar thing, but in the meat industry. And there's a lot more known about it, so we can talk a lot more about what actually goes on. But essentially, the allegations are that Agristats collects, you know, sensitive information from leading producers, Smithfield, Purdue, Tyson, to provide them information on, like, what are their flock sizes? What are their herd sizes? What are they selling their you know, meat as? And then because, you know, they pay millions of dollars to this service to be a part of it. And out comes, again, this price index. And they can feel confident raising their prices, knowing that their competitors would do the same. And so that would be called collusion if this is indeed what is happening. And that would be illegal to, you know, provide that sensitive information and to conspire with your competitors to raise prices. Because in a perfectly, you know, competitive market, you would want to, you know, keep your prices competitive so that you could, you know, draw in more business. But if you can confidently raise your price, knowing that your competitors would do so, you can gain more profit and the consumer is the one that loses there.
Hey, thank you. I'm speaking with Amanda Starbuck, Senior Food Research and Policy Analyst at Food and Water Watch. And log on to their website to read more of the economic cost of food monopolies, the rotten egg oligarchy. Hey, thank you, Amanda, for speaking with me this morning.
Thank you. Always a pleasure.
Take care. Hey, it's 8:55. I wanted to play a story from last night's WORT News. This was ahead of the election results, so you're going to have to look at the election results after you hear the story if you didn't hear it. The city council race is flooded with real estate cash.
14 Madison City Council races are competitive, and those campaigns have brought in almost $149,000 in donations since the start of this year, according to finance reports submitted ahead of today's election. This total excludes District 2 candidate Matt Egger, District 5 candidate Ulrika Dieterle, District 13 candidate Robert Luther, District 18 candidate Kevin Monroe, and District 20 candidate Sammy Kilgee. As of this report, their filings were not available on the city clerk's website. The most expensive city race this spring is between incumbent Alder Mike Revere and his challenger, Eli Sarofsky. They're running to represent downtown Madison and combined have received nearly $21,400 since January 1st, and they've spent just over $17,500. The next most expensive race is between incumbent Alder Nikki Conklin and her challenger, Dr. Joanne Perchette. They're running to represent Madison's far west side and combined have received more than $19,000 since January 1st. They've spent just over $16,400. The cheapest race this spring clocks in at just $1,000 raised since January 1st and just $200 spent. That's how much incumbent Westside Alder Tag Evers has spent to defend his seat against challenger Robert Luther. Luther's campaign finance reports are not available on the city clerk's website. Spending is also relatively low in the race between incumbent Westside Alder Regina Vitiver and her challenger Ulrika Dieterle. Dieterle's campaign finance reports are not available on the city clerk's website. While Alder Vitiver has raised just over $3,100 and spent $860 to defend her seat, the majority of direct candidate contributions this spring came from private citizens. But some local organizations cropped up frequently in the candidates' filings. AFSCME Wisconsin Council 32, Madison Professional Police Officers Association, and the Realtors Association of South Central Wisconsin. Under state law, political action committees can directly contribute up to $400 per candidate per election cycle. But there is a loophole, one that the Realtors Association is using to flood their preferred candidates with cash. PACs can spend unlimited funds on mailers and online advertising if they do so without coordinating with the candidates. That lack of coordination means that candidates' campaign finance reports don't tell the full story. The Housing Advocacy Fund, a political action committee funded by the Realtors Association of South Central Wisconsin, has independently invested nearly $92,000 this spring in six of their preferred candidates. The group has spent almost $13,600 in support of Wilahovich, a self-described Yes in My Backyard or YIMBY candidate who's vying for an open seat in downtown Madison. They spent just under $14,000 supporting incumbent downtown Alder Mike Revere, who served on the city council since 1995 and recently appeared alongside a panda in a series of comical ads on social media. They spent just over $13,600 backing incumbent Westside Alder Regina Vitiver, who's repeatedly supported changes to the city's zoning code that seek to promote more efficient housing development. They spent just over $13,500 supporting incumbent Alder Nikki Conklin. Her opponent, Dr. Joanne Perchette, has questioned the Realtors Association, namely, their motives in supporting housing density efforts in the city. They spent almost $13,300 backing incumbent Alder and current council president Janet Figueroa-Cole, who faces a challenger in former city staffer Lisa Veldren. And the group's biggest investment this spring was in support of incumbent Westside Alder John Huguer at just over $15,300. Alder Huguer faces challenger Nino Amato, a harsh critic of Mayor Satya Rhodes Conway, who last served on the city council in the 70s. The group's spending this spring is a significant drop compared to 2 years ago, when they invested nearly $170,000 to independently back nine of their preferred city council candidates. Three recipients in 2023 are back on the Realtors Association's list this year, though for slightly more modest sums. In 2023, the group invested $20,000 to back Alder Mike Revere's campaign, $9,000 to back Alder Nikki Conklin, and $20,000 to back Alder John Huguer, though they spelled his name incorrectly on the mailer. That investment made headlines, and the candidates collectively condemned the Housing Advocacy Fund's financial meddling, reports the Wisconsin State Journal.
And there's just a sentence left in that story, but I need to end there. That is from last evening's WORT News, and you can log on to hear the remainder of that. piece. Thank you to Dave Larson. Thank you to Tina. And I'm Jan Miyasaki. I'll talk with you next week.
You're listening to WRT 89.9 FM, Madison. Stay tuned. Surgeon Radio Kiosk, and then back to the country.
This is the Surgeon Radio Kiosk for Wednesday, April 2nd.
Texas, what the hell? Once again, my state's GOP hierarchy is leading the nation in creative ways to increase corporate power over people's rights. This time, lawmakers are rushing to protect corporate executives from legal challenges by their own shareholders. Their law would ban rank-and-file owners of corporate giants from suing their CEOs and other top officials for financial malfeasance. In particular, it's a heavy-handed attempt to prohibit shareholders from suing bosses who lavish shareholder funds on extravagant pay and luxury perks for themselves. But leave it to Lone Star Republicans to make a bad law worse. Indeed, they say they only want to bar suits by pesky small investors, people who own less than 3% of a corporation's stock. But that's a flimflam, since almost no one owns more than 3% of any big corporation. And the few who do are huge Wall Street operators and multi-billionaires, and they're not about to sue a fellow Richie for being greedy. So the Texas law would effectively